The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
I guess y'all can hear me. Okay. I don't have to project in here. Can you let me know at 20, by the way, just so I can wrap it up? Okay, this paper argues that in spite of a surface-level commitment to historically sensitive criticism, radical democratic theorists hyper-politicize philosophical concepts insofar as they base their political conclusions on a transcendental critique of the subject. This overextension of a philosophical theory is equivalent to the left Hegelian critical strategy that Marx and Engels lambasted as critical criticism. This strategy's reliance on philosophical critique undermines these theorists' opposition to liberalism as ideal, decontextualized, and abstract, insofar as the substitution of transcendental criticism for critiques of concrete political phenomena amounts to an identical ahistorical idealization of political phenomena as the one they critique, right? Put simply, this paper argues that deriving substantive political claims from a transcendental critique of subjectivity is equivalent to the classical rationalist philosophy of the subject these theorists reject. Such a move confuses the meta-theorical discourses about our discourses on politics with those discourses on politics themselves. So it's an indirect approach to left Hegelianism, so apologies, right? To meet the following task, I'll focus on Judith Butler, Slavoj Žižek, and Ernesto Laclau's dialogue in Contingency, Hegemony, and Universality. While not representative of their entire bodies of work, this dialogue is representative of an influential trajectory of leftist theory that views its tasks as incorporating anti-essentialist critiques of subjectivity and universality into a radical democratic political program. This paper is divided into three sections. In the first, I outline the basic aims of these three authors and examine their mutual accusations of formalism. In the second, I outline the affinities between these radical democratic theorists' critique of liberalism and Marx's own materialist break from his left Hegelian contemporaries. In the final section, I argue that these critics descend into formalism insofar as they overextend their meta-theoretical critique of philosophical concepts into a substantive criticism of concrete political phenomena. Okay. Staples.
Sorry.
It's my fault. Fumbling. Okay, first section. Thank you. Published at the beginning of the 2000s, Contingency, Hegemony, Universality, Contemporary Dialogues on the Left is, as its name suggests, emblematic of the concerns that dominated a broad swath of leftist political theory. This published conversation between Judith Butler, Ernesto Laclau, and Slavoj Žižek was part of the overall project of Verso's Phronesis book series, edited by Laclau and Chantal Mouffe. As their editorial introduction to the book series states, Phronesis aimed to redefine the left around the new political and theoretical nucleus exemplified by these authors. This self-conscious theoretical task was a response to the historical and political conjuncture marked by three decisive factors. First, the fall of the Berlin Wall. Second, the failed democratization of the former Soviet bloc. And third, the ideological rapprochement between neoliberal and social democratic movements, leading to the abandonment of oppositional leftist politics and the formation of a monolithic center-right. Surprisingly, given these clear historical and political exigencies, the discussion in Contingency, Hegemony, Universality included little analysis of this historical conjuncture. Discussion of the rise of third-way democracy and the dismantling of the welfare state are almost entirely absent. Moreover, the scant reference made to the political context, so a few scattered remarks about late capitalism by Laclau, a hyperbolic critique of postmodern consumer culture by Žižek, are either schematic or remain on the level of cultural and ideological analysis. To phrase the preceding worries in a different fashion, the theoretical differences between Butler, Žižek, and Laclau were less compelling than their underlying unanimity of approach. While all three authors critiqued the views of the other authors vociferously and defended their own, the subject matter of this debate remained almost exclusively focused on two predominant concerns of late 20th century continental thought, the constitution of subjectivity and the nature of universality. Indeed, the vast majority of the book's discussion centers on the author's attempt to articulate two key insights, thesis A, that the subject is constitutively incomplete, and thesis B, that universality is historically constituted. I'm going to refer to those in the third section as thesis A and thesis B, just to end of the second section too. All right. So given the rather profane task set before them, the author's substitution of a theoretical interrogation of sociopolitical reality with a reflection on the philosophical categories is concerning. Unsurprisingly, all three authors' voices concern. At various points, Butler, Zizek, and Laclau all accuse each other of formalism. While having different inflections throughout the debate, the charge of formalism consistently pointed to a worry by one of the discussants that their interlocutors were relying too heavily on dehistoricizing theoretical models tenuously connected to historical reality, and consequently, that their political claims amounted to repetitions of the liberal political models they rejected. So to outline the broad contours of this debate, Butler's first essay in the volume focused on the possible political implications of excessive formalism, voicing concerns of both Zizek and Laclau's theoretical analyses, rely on the indiscriminate and unreflective application of psychoanalytic and linguistic schemas onto historically specific political contexts. Butler's concern is that this formalist tendency leads to abstract generalizations that ignore the politically salient aspects of a particular context, leading to the normalization of these idealized features as ontological facts. Laclau voices a similar criticism of Zizek, arguing that Zizek's claims about class struggle are formal reductions of historical political conflicts to economic schemas. Laclau maintains that Zizek's reliance on the formal Marxist models of class politics and consequent fetishization of revolutionary paradigms preclude him from considering viable non-revolutionary political programs appropriate to the historical context of late capitalism. For his part, Zizek characterizes Laclau and Butler's historical contextualism and conceptualization of political struggle as the unending renegotiation of value claims as formalist. So, sorry, Zizek's characterizing that as formalist, right? In the sense that it takes historical contingency as a transcendental assumption. Zizek argues that Butler and Laclau, by claiming that contingency is a transcendental necessity and reducing politics to the infinite contestation of norms, essentialize the liberal capitalist politics by representing them as ontological conditions on the political. Thus, all three theorists continually worry that their theoretical models are unreflectively ahistorical and politically impotent. Right? Well, they accuse each other of it. Right, that's the point. Okay, so this worry marks another significant point of unanimity and divergence among the three participants. While all three authors were agreed on the formalist tendencies of the others, none of them could provide a defense of their theoretical positions that obviated that criticism. Moreover, as a final and telling point of consensus, none of these three authors interrogated the apparent validity of their mutual recriminations of formalism. That is, while the dialogue was premised on the theoretical convergence of these three thinkers, none of them asked whether the repeated worries about formalism stemmed from a shared feature of their methodological perspective. So before directly assessing the validity of this charge of formalism in the final section, in the next, I argue that these concerns with formalism stem from the affinity between these authors' critical strategy and the materialist strategy employed in Marx's theoretical break with his left Hegelian contemporaries. Okay, second section. The persistent concern with formalism expressed by the authors of contingency, hegemony, universality would be articulated within a classical Marxist framework in terms of the tendency of intellectual critique to descend in what Marx terms critical criticism, or to put it more frankly, into unrestrained idealism. Marx, in his rejection of the left Hegelians, criticized his contemporaries for their persistent focus on the incoherence and theological illusions of the reigning ideologies. This left Hegelian strategy attributed the continued failure of human emancipation to the understanding and misrecognition of the true causes of oppression. While Marx remained convinced that misunderstanding and misrecognition were constitutive elements of human oppression, he castigated the left Hegelians for overemphasizing the determinative role that ideological constructs played in maintaining the power of the exploiting class. Marx shifted focus away from the critique of German political philosophy and religion towards a critique of the capitalist mode of production and a historical analysis of class struggle was an attempt to identify the deeper causes of human immiseration. In short, Marx's transition from a philosophical critique of German philosophy to his critique of political economy was an attempt to transcend the mere criticism of ideology by providing a determinant understanding of the social relations of blocked human emancipation. Okay. So crucially, this materialist break with left Hegelianism rejected the idealization and overgeneralization inherent in their philosophical methodology. A key segment of Marx and Engels' first volume of the German Ideology contrasts the materialist view of history as a product of historically determinant individuals with the left Hegelian view of history as the emancipation of a universal subject, generally understood as man, right? Through the development of specific forms of consciousness. This left Hegelian view amounts to a form of idealist abstraction that remains divorced from its historical political conditions insofar as it, one, generalizes the self-consciousness of a specific individual or set of individuals as representative of the self-consciousness of the social whole, and two, reduces historical and social dynamics to that self-consciousness. This idealist view of history actively excludes the relationships of conflict and oppression characteristic of actual history, or represents them as just like rational conflicts, right? Thus, the German ideologues dehistoricize history precisely through their metonymic substitution of the consciousness of specific historical agents for history as a whole, or, put in other terms, they cut history out of history by talking about history as if it was a form of consciousness. Crucially, radical democratic theorists view their reflections on subjectivity and universality, such as the ones offered in Contingency, Hegemony, Universality, as a similar opposition to the dehistoricizing, idealizing, and generalizing tendencies of liberal democratic theory. As Butler argues, following Selah Benabib, two of the most notable proponents of this tradition, John Rawls and Jürgen Habermas, derive the normative principle of their accounts of democratic politics on purportedly universal features of human rationality. This suspicion of Rawls and Habermas identifies them with liberal consent theories. To cite Benabib's critique of Habermas, which Butler again cites with Contingency, Hegemony, and Universality, his project requires the fulfillment of the universalistic promise of bourgeois consent theories, which, since the 17th century, have always limited such universalism on the basis of, say, of sex, class, race, and other status considerations. This critique of Habermas, which Butler extends to Rawls, rests on the formal character of such universal claims by emphasizing the abstract, universally shared characteristics of the human subject in order to construct normative accounts of political decision-making. Rawls and Habermas exclude politically salient particularities of concrete subjects. To put this in the philosophical jargon of the authors of Contingency, Hegemony, Universality, Rawls and Habermas collapse the difference between the universal and the particular. Moreover, Habermas and Rawls both hold the conception of politics as a resolution of conflicts through rational decision-making procedures that stabilize an underlying normative consensus. Within these thinkers' formal models, and by these thinkers I mean Rawls and Habermas here, not Butler, Zizek, and Laclau, right? Democratic politics is the pursuit of the ideal of anticipated universal consensus, in keeping with their aims of reformulating an oppositional leftist politics. Butler, Zizek, and Laclau reject this model of democracy insofar as it merely reflects the imputed rational consensus posited by the hegemonic neoliberal center. So that's the tie to the original project they lay out in the beginning, in their editorial introduction. Butler, Zizek, and Laclau's collective rejection of Habermas and Rawls reflects a deep suspicion regarding this bourgeois project and its tendency to naturalize specific standards for reaching normative consensus by characterizing them as trans-historical standards of human rationality. The point of attack of all three thinkers is Rawls and Habermas's proposed identification between universal norms of rational consensus formation with a historically specific political order. This assault is philosophically formulated through a critique of the notion of universality. To quote the introduction to Contingency, Hegemony, Universality, we thus differentiate ourselves from the Habermasian effort to discover or conjure a pre-established universality, which is said to pertain to a rational feature of man, and a procedural form which presumes that the political field is constituted by rational actors. In contrast to this view, The three authors propose a notion of universality that is not a static presumption, nor an a priori given, but rather ought to be understood as a process or condition irreducible to its determinate modes of appearance. Sorry for the mumbles, I'm quoting Butler, Zizek in the Cloud, which is almost like a pain in the ass, right? Thus, to return to the thesis, to return to thesis B that I identified in the first section, these three authors propose that we should conceive of universality as constituted through historical and practical processes in order to highlight the constitutive exclusions of normative bourgeois universalism. Consequently, all three authors view the aims of oppositional leftism to be achieved by revealing the spurious character of the imputed consensus underlying the bourgeois liberal social order, thereby rendering it open to theoretical and political contestation. The radical democratic critique of liberal rationalism, like Marx and Engels' critique of the left Hegelians, challenges ahistorical conceptions of the historically constituted political order by critiquing its tendency to reduce its social-political dynamics to idealized features of rational subjectivity. However, as I will argue in the following section, radical democratic theorists undermine this materialist strategy by overextending their philosophical critique of subjectivity to a substantive critique of actual historical phenomena and concrete political movements. This tension is evident in their ambivalent attitude to the Marxist tradition and explains their both their tendency to engage in formalism and their theoretical blindness to them. So it explains the impasse that you get in the dialogue where they're just like, you're a formalist, you're a formalist, you're a formalist, and like no one's like, why are we all saying this, right? Do you mind if I have some water, Dad?
It's deep, yeah.
Yeah, it's good. That's good.
I just didn't want to have like a nasty surprise.
Yeah, that's cool. Thank you. Okay, so third section. Given the commitment by all three authors to the inheritance of a certain Marxist problematic, the concerns with formalism evinced by Zizek, Butler, and Laclau can be construed as an intellectual remnant of the critical concerns expressed by the early Marx. To return to the first section, the concern with formalism, like the accusations they level against each other, all revolved around the suspicion that all three authors overextend their transcendental schemas to historically specific political phenomena. However, as I will argue, critical reflection on these formalist tendencies is precluded by the presumed importance of their formal models presupposed by their theoretical project. To cite the editorial mission statement from Phronesis, and I'm just citing it to show that their commitment to it, I'm sorry for the long quote, Phronesis' objective is to establish a dialogue among all those who assert the need to redefine the left-right distinction. Our original concern, which was to bring together left-wing politics and the theoretical developments around the critique of essentialism, is more pertinent than ever. Indeed, we still believe that the most important trends in contemporary theory, deconstruction, psychoanalysis, the philosophy of language, as initiated by the latter Wittgenstein and post-Heideggerian hermeneutics, are the necessary conditions for understanding the widening of social struggles characteristic of the present stage of democratic politics, and for formulating the new vision of the left in terms of radical and plural democracy. So they're just, whatever you think about these theories that they're citing here, they're just, five minutes left?
Yeah.
Okay, they're just presuming the importance of it, is my point, right? That makes sense? Analytically and strategically. Oh, good time. Okay, so these assertions of the pertinence, importance, and necessity of anti-essentialist philosophy are underwritten by their application of anti-essentialist critiques of subjectivity and universality to liberals such as Rawls and Habermas, which is what we did in the last section, and crucially, traditional Marxist theories. Reviewing the interconnection between thesis A, right, the constitutive incompletion of the subject, and thesis B, the historical nature of universality, right? So reviewing the interconnection between those two theses can illuminate the drift from Laclau, Butler, and Zizek's historicizing aspirations into abstract formalism, right? So the anti-essentialist critique of Rawls and Habermas by Laclau, Zizek, and Butler, right, hinges on the interconnected criticisms of the philosophical concepts of universality and subjectivity. Following the line of criticism reviewed in the previous section, the notion that universality is produced through a contingent historical process is a logical consequence of the structural incompletion of the subject. At least that's how they derive the argument, right? According to Laclau, Zizek, and Butler, the traditional liberal appeal to dehistoricize universal features of rationality founders in light of the anti-essentialist insight that subjects are relationally constituted through historically specific processes of performance, identification, and hegemonic articulation. Thus, these thinkers view Habermas and Rawls's normative models as rationalist philosophies of the subject that deny its constitutive incompletion by subsuming particularities under the universal. Right? So, crucially, right, these thinkers tend to construe traditional Marxism as an extension of the same rationalist philosophy. Right? So the radical democratic framework roughly shared by these three thinkers views the continued failure of the socialist project as a failure of political agency to be theoretically interrogated in motivational terms through a theory of subjectivity and in normative terms through a theory of universality. According to the common refrain, Marxism failed because it failed to articulate a political identity that is a form of subjectivity sufficiently capable of motivating committed political action and a conception of universal emancipation sufficiently expansive enough to encompass the aspirations of internally differentiated social movements. This failure, which these thinkers view as constitutive of emancipatory politics, is due to the aporetic relation between the demand for a sufficiently broad normative conception of political action, that is, universality, and the components of a subjective identity that motivate political action, that is, particularity. So following Laclau and returning to like the sort of jargon they use, revolutionary emancipation is construed as a reconciliation of the moments of universality and particularity, which, from a classical philosophical perspective, is impossible. Thus, for these thinkers, the Marxist attempt to identify the proletarian class with the subject of the historical process of universal emancipation, like the universal appeal to universal rationality that they find in Rawls and Habermas, mm-hmm. founders in light of the structural incompleteness of the subject and the historically conditioned and contingent character of universality. Thus, according to these three thinkers, Marxism's failures are the result of a classical philosophical error, and that's really what I'm taking issue with, like this interpretation, mm-hmm. right? Okay. So these distinct criticisms of traditional Marxism and liberal theory are ostensibly united by their shared foundation in an anti-essentialist critique of the subject. However, this assimilation of Marxism and liberal theory to a classical political philosophy conflates a meta-theoretical, that is, a philosophical, transcendental, or formal critique of theories about politics with a criticism of the substantive objectives of historically specific social movements. Or, at best, it acts as if the coherence of the former, like the meta-theories, right, determine the relative success or failure of the latter. Right? Thus, in spite of their ostensible concerns with formalism, the critical strategy of these radical democratic theorists presupposes that concrete historical and political phenomena can be determinatively theorized in terms of a philosophical meta-theory on subjectivity and universality. This analytical presupposition remains common to all three thinkers. While the criticism of the traditional socialist politics provided in the previous paragraphs drew far more heavily from Laclau than, say, like for example, like Zizek, right? All three thinkers maintain this analytical presupposition insofar as they either, like, do one of these two things, right? One, draw substantive political inferences from their transcendental analysis, or two, mobilize those inferences to critique concrete political programs. As the preceding analysis has shown, these presuppositions underwrite their entire theoretical project. These methodological presuppositions tend to hyper-politicize philosophical concepts. That is, they overinvest philosophical meta-analysis of conceptual frameworks with an unwarranted political importance, or it's merely presumed like it was in the previous paragraph that I cited from them, right? A program of political contestation licensed by the structural incompletion of the subject and the logical irreducibility of particularity and universality is only possible through the persistent substitution of political motivations with philosophical problems. Crucially, this hyper-politicization of philosophy undermines the critical potential of radical democratic theory vis-a-vis the liberal theorists they critique, right? So this is the conclusion. Sorry if I'm running like a little long, right? Okay. Despite their political disagreements with the rationalist tradition of liberal and social democratic thought, Butler, Zizek, and Laclau all share a common methodological premise with Rawls and Habermas, insofar as all these thinkers interrogate politics primarily through an analysis of the texts, concepts, and methodology characteristic of the philosophical tradition. Obviously, we can argue about this point for some of these figures, but yeah. Consequently, criticism amounts to the theoretical revelation of misrecognition internal to the symbolic structures that organize norms and constitute subjects. Thus, these thinkers hyper-politicize philosophy by substituting political debates with philosophical ones. That is, they talk about politics as if it was philosophy and vice versa. Thus, I contend that these radical Democrats' substitution of political analysis with analysis of...
Let you finish your thought.
With analysis of philosophical theories about politics is equivalent to the left Hegelian substitution of history with theories about history. This confluence is non-accidental, given that the radical Democrats' mobilization of anti-essentialist philosophy construes Marx's break with philosophical criticism as a break with the content of the established philosophical tradition, rather than a break with the tendency to overextend philosophical methodologies characteristic of the idealist view of history. In short, after Marx's critical intervention against young Hegelianism and his rejection of philosophical critique as a predominant mode of social critique, radical democratic criticism has, through the circuitous paths of history, returned to the task of critical criticism, as Marx's ambivalent successors have attempted to save the contemporary left left from drowning by critiquing the idea of gravity.
Thank you, Josh. Next up will be Dan, who's going to be presenting a paper titled "Whose Universalism?"
All right.
Dan, take it away.
Thank you. The full title is "Whose Universalism? Deepesh Chakrabarty and the Anthropocene." So I'm going to be telling, I guess, a similar sort of story, although as you'll see, the details are a little bit different. So paper starts off with a quote from the German ideology, where Marx and Engels are talking about Bruno Bauer, and they say that he, quote, accepts the speculative contradiction and upholds one part of it against the other. A philosophical phrase about a real question is for him the real question itself. Okay. So one of the most striking features of climate change, since young Hegelian, sorry, here we go, is that it both develops out of the same processes as existing north-south inequalities and greatly exacerbates them. The massive emissions generated in the course of northern capitalist development, ever-expanding accumulation made possible through and sustained by slavery, colonialism, and other forms of imperialism, unpaid domestic work, and the persistence of segmented labor markets, are largely responsible for climate change. Climate change, in turn, now greatly amplifies these structural inequalities with its hugely disproportionate effects upon the populations of the global south. Despite having contributed very little to the problem, the world's poor today are on the front lines of the climate crisis, and they must play a central role in attempts to reverse these injustices and institute a more equitable and sustainable global order. One would therefore expect post-colonial theory, which purports to be a politically oriented intellectual program concerned with the emancipation of precisely such people, to be deeply engaged with the social dynamics of climate change and ecological crisis more generally, right? Given these really stark and remarkable structural injustices. However, Deepesh Chakrabarty, one of the most prominent post-colonial scholars to write substantively about climate change, actually consistently downplays the crucial historical and structural differences and particularities involved in the problem, arguing that the climate crisis requires humanity as a whole to confront its shared responsibility for the crisis at the level of the species. This interpretive decision, might seem odd. Given the strong focus on difference and the rejection of humanism and universalism that have characterized postcolonial discourse nearly since its emergence, postcolonial theory and Chakrabarty's work in particular largely defined itself in distinction to Enlightenment thought and its purported universality. However, upon closer inspection, this initially unexpected shift from the rejection of universals in history to an enthusiastic embrace of a highly abstract universalism may in fact be perfectly comprehensible. And I'm going to talk about that. I'm also going to say that it is politically disastrous.
So to show this, I'll begin by reconstructing part of Chakrabarty's central argument from a few of his recent essays about climate change. I'll then consider the issues with the argument and attempt to explain why he's pushed to make it anyway, despite serious problems, many of which he actually himself acknowledges. Okay, so real quick, I'm going to just go try and give you the short Chakrabarty spiel. Chakrabarty's central claim is that, quote, post-colonial thinking may need to be stretched to adjust itself to the reality of global warming. In an article entitled The Climate of History, he says that his readings in, quote, subaltern studies and post-colonial criticism over the last 25 years had not really prepared him for making sense of the planetary conjuncture within which humanity finds itself today, end quote. Although post-colonial theory, with its acknowledgement of anthropological difference, is for Chakrabarty generally preferable to Enlightenment ideologies, quote, prominent among them Marxism and liberalism, end quote, that understand people as potentially the same everywhere, neither help us to make sense of an, quote, environmental crisis that is no doubt mediated by the inequities of capitalist development, but that faces humanity as a whole, end quote. And this is because climate change, Chakrabarty argues, spells the collapse of the age-old humanist distinction between natural history and human history, a distinction which all previous social theories are said to have upheld. Of course, the audience here will no doubt be aware that Marx's philosophical project is founded in precisely the contrary impulse. In the German ideology, for example, Marx and Engels castigate Bruno Bauer for speaking of, quote, the antitheses in nature and history as though these were two separate things, and man did not always have before him a historical nature and a natural history, end quote. Benita Perry points out that Chakrabarty, quote, does not refer to the extensive writings on ecological issues by scholars on the left, for whom human history is necessarily unthinkable outside of its dialectical relation to natural history, both intimately bound up with the rise of the capitalist world order, end quote. And I'm going to return to this point in a minute. Okay. What this apparent impasse requires, Chakrabarty explains, is a third figure of the human beyond the Marxist liberal universal one and the post-colonial, you know, anthropological difference particular one, a third figure of the human as, a, quote, a species, a collectivity whose commitment to fossil fuel-based energy-consuming civilization is now a threat to that civilization itself, end quote. And this is precisely what is offered by thinkers of the Anthropocene, who Chakrabarty says give an account of climate change that is neither purely natural nor purely human history. An account which Chakrabarty himself enthusiastically endorses in its main details, even while acknowledging that is in direct conflict with what he calls the philosophies of difference. Of course, Chakrabarty has long been a philosopher of difference. It is therefore not surprising that he does not simply want to abandon the post-colonial perspective altogether. Instead, he embraces the incongruity, arguing that we must simultaneously hold in mind these disjunctive views, quote, through moves that in their simultaneity appear contradictory. For Chakrabarty, the other figures of the human, the Marxist liberal and the postcolonial, are not irrelevant or obsolete, although it's not clear on his account what the Marxist figure is really adding, since it's been superseded by postcolonial theory. They're simply insufficient to deal with the fact that humans having become a geophysical force. Only by incorporating the Anthropocene's flattening species perspective, Chakrabarty asserts, can we begin to make sense of this fact. Okay. So I think Chakrabarty's correct that the global challenge of climate change in some ways highlights the limits of his brand of postcolonial theory. However, rather than overcoming these limits, Chakrabarty's turn to the Anthropocene actually introduces novel difficulties. For thinkers like atmospheric chemist Paul Crutzen, who popularized the terms, this is originally coming out of more the natural science side of things, has been picked up by the social sciences. Crutzen argues that the Anthropocene is characterized by the seriousness of humanity's impacts on nature on a geological scale. Chakrabarty follows them in assigning, quote, an agency to humans at the very heart of his account, repeatedly insisting that humans collectively now have an agency in determining the climate of the planet as a whole. As a way of understanding ecological crisis, I want to argue that this abstract construction has severe limits. In particular, it excludes any substantive analysis of the human scale factors and historical logics that actually drive the transformation of the climate. The ecological particularities of social structures and economic systems are occluded, as are huge and analytically crucial differentials in responsibility, agency, and vulnerability across class, nationality, race, and gender. Jason Moore and others have demonstrated that this erasure of historical geographical patterns of differentiation and coherence in the interests of narrative simplicity leads to a fixation on technology or industrialization in the abstract as the driver of historical change, excluding, quote, the forces of capital and empire that have cohered modern world history. Because the Anthropocene framework is characterized by its apparent transcendence of merely human-scale histories, its shoehorning into political theory adds to the ad hoc and contradictory character of Chakrabarty's theoretical solution. Chakrabarty recognizes some of the problematic political consequences of this incongruity. He concedes, for example, that the species-level universality he wishes to splice in is devoid of normative content. This species is, quote, a collective mode of existence that is justice blind. And the injustices and inequalities with which post-colonial thinkers are ordinarily concerned simply find no purchase here. He further acknowledges that the species-level perspective he advocates is politically ineffectual. Although it's simplistically asserted that humans as a species are producing the crisis, Chakrabarty argues that there is, quote, no humanity that can act as a self-aware agent. The fact that the crisis of climate change will be routed through all of our anthropological differences can only mean that, however anthropogenic the current climate warming may be in its origins, there is no corresponding humanity that in its oneness can act as a political agent, end quote. So the allegedly foundational act of anthropological difference still forecloses for Chakrabarty the possibility of any sort of efficacious global political action. The most we can hope for, in his view, are partial and fragmented struggles in the face of a genuinely global challenge. Chakrabarty's position effaces both the structural differentials and the potential solidarities between people, emphasizing at once a vacuous universality and an essentialized cultural difference. As with other Anthropocene thinkers, such an approach tends to encourage anti-political solutions like better technologies, geoengineering, etc., that marginalize rather than prioritize, in Moore's words, the relations of power, capital, and nature that have rendered fossil capitalism so deadly in the first place. It also lends itself to a Malthusian emphasis on population that ought to be anathema to post-colonial theory. Yet in an article entitled Climate and Capital on Conjoined Histories, Chakrabarty argues that we urgently need to confront the problem of population and that the, quote, poor participate in the shared history of human evolution, whereby we have evolved to be the dominant species of the planet, spreading all over it and now threatening the existence of many other life forms, just as much as the rich do. Rather than pointing towards a solidaristic emancipatory global politics, the need for which is so clearly highlighted by the climate crisis, Chakrabarty's analysis instead undermines it. That's the general, assessment that I'm giving of his argument. And now I want to try and say a few words about why I think he makes this argument, even though it makes no sense given his overall, or at least seems to make no sense given his previous intellectual history. Okay. So Chakrabarty understands that these conclusions will be seen as troubling by those concerned with justice and freedom, but he sees no recourse except to simply abstract himself beyond these concerns to the level of the species. In fact, however, this apparently aporetic situation arises only from the way that Chakrabarty has described it. In his account, Marxism is seen to be making certain falsifiable claims about capitalism, history, and human nature, wrongly universalizing particular European trends and attitudes. Postcolonial theory corrects this, but neither is equipped to talk about causation and effects of climate change at the level of the species, which is the only way that Chakrabarty sees available for us to meaningfully talk about universality. I believe this narrative depends upon various misunderstandings that result from Chakrabarty's idealism. In an essay entitled Can Political Economy Be Postcolonial?, Chakrabarty acknowledges that postcolonial theory has been subject to criticism from Marxist or other left-leaning intellectuals who complained that postcolonial thinking emphasized textual criticism at the expense of political economic analysis, a charge that he does not quite deny. He says he, quote, does not know whether or not the turn towards the cultural textual meant that subaltern studies neglected economic history. It seems clear, though, that it did. In an article entitled Bringing Capital Back in, A Materialist Turn in Postcolonial Studies, Sandra Mazadra points out that over the last few decades, the concern with culture has been progressively disentangled from any concern with the material transformations of capitalism, and that this has led, quote, many scholars engaged in cultural and postcolonial studies to take capitalism for granted, to assume it as the neutral background of their research, and thus unconsciously validate the objectivity of its structural developments and laws. Now, this is not exactly the case with Chakrabarty himself, who in fact speaks a great deal about capitalism and takes himself to be critical of it. Rather, the problem seems to lie in a misunderstanding about the nature of capitalism and universality and the relationship between them. Although Chakrabarty writes a lot about capitalism, his understanding of it is primarily normative. As Vivek Chipper rightly points out in Postcolonial Theory and the Spectre of Capital, Chakrabarty's conception of capitalism actually largely conforms with the liberal accounts that equate it with the spread of rights, democracy, freedom, and secularism. Rather than critiquing it as an ideology, Chakrabarty accepts the bourgeois apologia of capitalism and then argues that the persistence of local customs and hierarchies in the ex-colonies gainsays claims of capitalism's universalization, a universalization which is supposed to have failed because of an invalid extrapolation of universal human nature from particular European modes of thought and belief. Chakrabarty confuses the spread of abstract labor in the technical sense in which Marx uses it and with the homogenization of labor relations and norms. So Chibber, I think, rightly points out that what Chakrabarty calls anthropological difference does not necessarily persist in spite of and against capitalism, as Chakrabarty believes, but is also often absolutely indispensable to it, not just in the origins of the capitalist mode of production as Marx argued, but also for its continued reproduction. So I want to just, as an aside, say that in pointing this out, I don't wish to argue that many Marxists have not been economistic and Eurocentric, not to mention anti-ecological, overly anthropocentric, and so on. They surely have, and a considerable number of us continue to be. And as Mazzadra also argues, Marxist historians have too often confined to the beginning of capitalist history such anomalous processes, quote, anomalous processes, as the seizing of native lands and the employment of indentured or enslaved labor, without considering the continuous reproduction of their traces within the shape of citizenship and the composition of labor. So because such processes actually remain crucial for capital, Mazzadra points out, free wage labor cannot be presented anymore as capitalist standard and norm, and that dispossession and direct expropriation, as opposed to exploitation in Marx's technical sense, far from only shaping historical capitalism, are also constitutive of contemporary global capitalism. So I just wanted to say this because I think that, like, we can actually understand why Chakrabarty has the reactions that he does, right? So I want to place it in the context of a longer intellectual history, which says that we actually do play some blame for the trajectory. We do have to take some of the blame for the trajectory that post-colonial studies subsequently took. And I actually want to say that Chibber is part of this as well. I think he has sort of a misguided attempt to ground Marxism in rational choice accounts of universal human nature that we don't need, and that actually, like, muddies the waters at precisely the wrong moment. So I'm not just trying to, like, shit on Chakrabarty one-sidedly here. But I just want to say that although these failures of mainstream Marxism may help to explain Chakrabarty's position, they don't excuse it. So the result of such confusions, allowed for by the flight to the symbolic and the abandonment of political economy in particular, is that Chakrabarty consistently misrepresents or simply misunderstands the criticisms directed at his position from the left. This can be seen, for example, in his response to Slavoj Žižek. In Living in the End Times, Žižek argues against Chakrabarty that, quote, the whole is contained by its part, that the fate of the whole, life on Earth here, hinges on what goes on in what was formerly one of its parts, the socioeconomic mode of production of one of the species on Earth. Chakrabarty responds to this by saying that confronting capitalism cannot be the key to addressing climate change because, quote, the problem of the Anthropocene warming could not have been predicted from within the usual frameworks deployed to study the logics of capital. Climate change is a problem defined and constructed by climate scientists whose research methods, analytical strategies, and skill sets are different from those possessed by students of political economy. So the Chakrabarty considers this a response to Žižek's argument, I think, evinces a basic confusion concerning the relationship between structures and discourses about them, right? This lack of conceptual grounding lends itself well to sophistic sleights of hand. In Climate and Capital, the word capitalism is by turns used to signify or framed as equivalent to industrial civilization, the market, cost-benefit thinking, and income inequality, whatever is convenient for casually rejecting any particular criticism. So this allows him to claim, for example, that John Bellamy Foster, Brett Clark, and Richard York are wrong to suggest that the ecological crisis is one of capitalism, since if income inequality, this is Chakrabarty here, since if income inequality was less severe and the world were more just, quote, the climate crisis would be worse, because there would be even more emissions, right? Thus, Chakrabarty says, logically speaking, and here in the text I have a little parenthetical exclamation mark next to it, like Marx likes to do in the German ideology. Logically speaking, the climate crisis is not inherently a result of economic inequalities. It is really a matter of the quantity of greenhouse gases we put out into the atmosphere. Those who connect climate change exclusively to historical origins formations of income inequalities in the modern world raise valid questions about historical inequalities, but a reduction of the problem of climate change to that of capitalism, folded into the histories of modern European expansions and empires, only blinds us to the nature of our present, a present defined by the coming together of the relatively short-term processes of human history and other much longer-term processes that belong to the history of the Earth system and of life on the planet. Now, I think hopefully we can see that this is, of course, no refutation of Foster, Clark, and York's argument at all. One of the preconditions and results of capitalist activity, material inequality, is here substituted for the whole, obscuring ecologically relevant characteristics of capitalism, such as the necessity of self-valorizing value to expand, the ceaseless production of needs, the privileging of exchange value over use value, and the necessary externalization and devaluation of nature, the competitive pressures to focus on short-term gain, the heteronomy and alienation of capitalist production, and the separation of people from their means of subsistence. Similar slippages allow Chakrabarty to wave away the relationships between capitalism and population, technological innovation, and energy usage. I'm going to wrap up now. So the failure to theorize capitalism and the rejection of analyses of its ecological particularities is what allows Chakrabarty to follow the Anthropocene thinkers in attributing the massive changes in our socio-natural relations to apparently contingent changes in our collective technological capacities as a species. He's left with no way to distinguish the more or less universal features of human life, our use of tools, language, etc., from the specific ecological compulsions of capitalist society, and no way to theorize the inequalities and injustices of climate change in relation to processes of capital accumulation. Yet this is precisely what is required to make sense of our situation today, both with respect to the drivers of ecological crisis and the possibility of constructing theoretical and political responses adequate to it. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Our last speaker will be Aaron Jaffe, who will be presenting a paper titled Marxist Strategies for Critique Amongst the Young Hegelians. So, Aaron?
Thank you, and thanks for being here early on a Sunday. I really appreciate it. So since the 2008 crisis and its incredibly poor recovery, along with many of the political developments that occurred after it, most of which were far better discussed in other elements of this conference than I'll be capable of. There have been a few recent calls for a return to Marx, or an openness to the thought that Marx got it right. And I think, to be sure, Marx got a lot, and I want to stress a lot, I think a real lot, got a lot right. But simply peering into his writing desk, as if setting things right for all times were possible, won't provide the critical theories or conclusions that we might need today. This is not because our time is in any way post-capitalist, but because Marx's convictions did not spring ready-made from the absolute validity of his mind. In other words, we need to do a bit more than open our mouths and wait for the roast pigeons of Marx's knowledge to fly in. Here, I want to suggest that strategies for critique appropriate to our time can best be appreciated not so much in the content, but in the method that Marx developed while differentiating himself from young Hegelians that he himself was a part of in the early 1840s. Now, all of the young Hegelians had to confront in the 1840s conditions that are in some ways strikingly familiar to us today. Among them, reactionary political leadership stripping what had been a thin veneer of liberalism, I'm thinking of Frederick Wilhelm IV, scarce and precarious academic opportunities, increased state surveillance of dissent, ideological and theoretical confusion among those who pretended to offer critical theories, a hyper-charged but politically empty atheism, and a general lack of careful, detailed social analysis in the midst of growing social unrest. In tracking Marx's methodological development in the midst of these issues, we can not only gain a window into his own strategies for critique, but gain insights into the promise of our own contemporary social environment. So, in the space of a few short years in the early 1840s, Marx transitioned from writing a dissertation on ancient philosophy in an attempt to secure a teaching position at the University of Bonn with his friend and mentor Bruno Bauer, to writing intentionally incendiary polemics against the same Bauer, as well as the Prussian establishment responsible for revoking the latter's teaching license. Marx's transition began when he began focusing on specific local conditions as contributing editor at minor left-leaning but certainly not radical newspapers. With a burgeoning political consciousness, romantic and idealist but not yet revolutionary, far from communist, and with the unfulfillable dreams of an academic in waiting, Marx looked to make a name for himself among the publicly engaged intellectual leaders he respected. On one extreme, Bauer, a staunch supporter of Marx for years. Bauer even once wrote to Marx demanding that he finish his dissertation, since doing so was merely a formality towards credentialing such an obviously talented student. Bauer was a member, of course, of the close-knit young Hegelians who dominated Marx's intellectual scene. As readers of Hegel committed to further developing his system with cultural and political critique, they pointed to the ways a liberal state and liberal politics, despite the great idea of their master, was far from being actualized. Bauer in particular advanced republican ideals by criticizing theology, showing how it promoted existing conservative arrangements. On the other extreme, opposite Bauer, I want to suggest was Ludwig Feuerbach. Although Bauer had wanted to collaborate with Marx and Feuerbach on a journal, Bauer and Feuerbach diverged in a few important ways, and this distance likely prevented the journal project from coming to fruition. Feuerbach's criticism of theology rested on a different strategy from Bauer's. While initially drawn to the young Hegelian approach, Feuerbach later found that the focus on consciousness and ideas was itself fundamentally theological, because like theology proper, young Hegelians were idealists removed from what he would call the sensuous essence of humanity. For Marx, Feuerbach's critique was a positive step. The sensuous essence of humanity was, in its manifold diversity, precisely what he was covering in his journalism. But Feuerbach was content with attacking both young Hegelianism and state power with this theoretical humanism, the sensuous essence of humanity. Of course, for Marx, this was just another abstract idea. While pointing to a better foundation for thinking the human essence, Feuerbach's critique was indirect, academic, and its critical force was anemic. Whereas Bauer's critique was explicitly political, Feuerbach intentionally avoided any provocation of the censors with his philosophical critique of what he would think at some times purely legitimate institutions. We are thus presented with two academics, one whose politics conflicted so overtly with official power that his polemics forfeited his career, Bauer, and the other for whom consistently straightforward polemics were out of the question, Feuerbach. In the context of scarce academic opportunities and a state that policed speech, Marx's alternatives seemed to be state silencing or self-censorship. The young Marx, however, was constitutively incapable of abiding by either form of academic quietism. We know that Marx was likely incapable of the restraint Feuerbach showed, given his violent reaction to what Feuerbach called prudence and moderation. In an 1842 critique of Prussian state censorship, Marx wrote, and I quote, "Truth is as little modest as it is light, and towards whom should it be so? Towards itself? If modesty is the characteristic feature of the investigation, then it is a sign that truth is feared rather than falsehood. The law permits me to write, only I must write in a style that is not mine," end quote. At this stage, Marx didn't think Feuerbach's critique was wrong so much as he thought it could be weaponized in a more powerful manner. Oppressive conditions demanded opposition in a far more determinate material register, and Marx saw quite clearly that Feuerbach's restrained, coded position was a recipe for neutering any political power his writing itself might otherwise have had. At this early stage, Marx was still a thinker and writer concerned with the force of ideas, as opposed to material praxis, precisely because he thought ideas were uniquely forceful. He wrote, "We are firmly convinced that the real danger lies not in practical attempts, but in the theoretical elaboration of communist ideas." This is Marx now. "The real danger lies in the theoretical elaboration of communist ideas. For practical attempts, even mass attempts, can be answered by cannon as soon as they become dangerous. Whereas ideas, which have conquered our intellect and taken possession of our minds, ideas to which reason has fettered our conscience, are chains from which one cannot free oneself without a broken heart. They are demons which human beings can vanquish only by submitting to them." That's October 1842, Marx. While no less idealist than Feuerbach, Marx's commitments were already more forceful in two ways that deserve being highlighted. First, beyond mere principle, there were the rudiments of a psychology by which ideas could prove motivating. And second, Marx clearly appreciated the need to confront state violence, the canons. While academic work out of the picture, state power held little self-censoring pull for Marx. Prior to Bauer's firing in a February 1842 letter, Marx insisted on anonymity, signing his name only by a Rhinelander. And he asked the editor, Ruge, not to mention my name to anyone. So that's in February. In March, in a March letter of the same year, Marx informed Ruge who he was writing to, of Bauer's dismissal. So Marx is writing to a dude saying, like, my mentor just got fired. And he opens with, I think it would be better to include my name among the others. Right, so you can see the moment Marx makes this shift. I think it would be better to include my name among the others. And in another letter, just 15 days later, Marx insists that a certain fanaticism in tone is necessary. All right. Marx's increasingly radical critique is tied to the way his social-political environment conditioned the possibilities of his own work. That sounds like a Marxian insight. Marx sought to fashion his own prose as a humanist weapon against powers that restrained his freedom, and in precisely this way, Marx's earliest Feuerbachianism is already beyond Feuerbach's basic problematic, despite what any Althusserians might tell you. In 1843, Marx wanted to distance himself, so this is a little bit later now. In 1843, Marx wanted to distance himself from a group, the Free, who construed freedom in a dilettante, merely ideal manner. He insisted that analysis pay, quote, more definiteness, more attention to the actual state of affairs, acquire more expert knowledge, end quote. In another letter, again to Ruge, who's kind of like a central figure for early Marx, he developed a similar critique of Feuerbach, holding that, quote, Feuerbach refers too much to nature and too little to politics. That, however, politics, is the only alliance by which present-day philosophy can become truth, end quote. I think that's a huge claim. The standards for philosophical truth were, for Marx, deeply tied to, quote, the actual state of affairs, end quote, which, because it is neither transparently revealed in everyday experience nor grasped immediately via philosophy, itself requires more expert knowledge. Philosophical truth is neither independent of politics nor merely the rhetorically charged criticism of existing political conditions. And I think Josh did an excellent job of highlighting this. Rather, in a modified Hegelianism, for Marx, the critique and its object must coincide. Hegel's dictum that the real is rational and the rational is real becomes, in Marx's hands, the truth lying at the conjuncture of a critically charged philosophy and informed interventions into the actual state of affairs. Marx's critique of Feuerbach is that philosophical criticism that is not rooted in such a conjuncture is not only barren, but false. Marx's critique of the Free was that social realities required careful empirical investigation rather than armchair sociology or critical phrase mongering. A philosophical or rhetorical approach that left existing conditions unchanged couldn't even be considered true. And the actualization of philosophical truth was impossible in Prussia because of social and political conditions, including the conservative recentering of religion, censor suppression of dissent, and the glaring lack of freedom generally. Philosophical work had to find an explicit ground in, or alliance with, interventions into the actual state of affairs in order to accomplish the truth. Although many are familiar with Marx's famous 11th thesis on Feuerbach from 1845, that the point of philosophy is not merely to interpret the world but to change it, I think these letters to Ruge, which I've been relying on at least 2 years earlier, show Marx's commitment to an even more radical idea. Marx's innovative development from 1842 to 43 was to insist that the truth of philosophy required substantive interventions into the institutions and practices that regulated philosophy's relation to its environment, real, concrete, and social way. By late 1843, Marx had articulated a critique of both the philosophy practiced by his peers and mentors and the actual state of the world. Marx found a way to weld together Feuerbach's philosophical humanism and Bauer's political relevance. Feuerbach's careful, writerly, political quietism could not straightforwardly be alloyed with Bauer's boldness, and Bauer's abstractions could not be mediated with Feuerbach's insistence on sensuous this-worldliness. To overcome the problematic elements of each, a new grounding was required. And Marx's earliest attempts at this, in March of 1842, are romantic and imprecise, so I'm giving you the early version. This is a quote from Marx. Now, writers with this earthly position, for after all, a position on plowland is surely earthly, would be desirable, and even more so if in the future the plow were to think and write instead of the pen, while the pen, on the other hand, were to perform serf labor in return. Perhaps, in view of the present uniformity of the German governments, this will come to pass. But the more uniform the governments, the more multiform nowadays are the philosophers, and it is to be hoped that the multiform army will conquer the uniform one. That's the early. Thanks. By August of 1842, a robust change is apparent again in Marx's approach. I'll quote again. In any case, we arouse the resentment of many, indeed the majority, of the free-thinking, practical people who have undertaken laborious task of winning freedom step by step within the constitutional framework, while we, from our comfortable armchair of abstractions, show them their contradictions. True, the author of the Just Milieu article invites criticism, but we all know how governments respond to such challenges. It is not enough for someone to express readiness to hear criticism, for which in any case permission won't be asked. The question is whether we have selected the appropriate arena. Newspapers only begin to be the appropriate arena for such questions when these have become questions of the real state, that is, practical questions, end quote. So, the early emphasis on the earthly held promise but was ultimately mystifying. This latter emphasis on the ground, of varyingly fertile arenas and conditions, not yet economic ones for Marx, but the concrete possibilities for practical questions and political resistance, that change in focus would prompt Marx's break with Bauer. While his polemics were indeed politically charged, Bauer attacked abstract entities like religious consciousness, spirit, or the German people, as if that was a thing, and sought to enthrone universal self-consciousness rather than investigate the specific conditions of alienation. Marx replaced these abstractions with practical questions of the state, economics, and an insistence on locating individuals and their possibilities of consciousness within social organization. Bauer's unmoored abstraction risked detracting from careful investigation of the actual state of affairs, and Marx increasingly came to think of Bauer as engaged not so much in good philosophy or politics, but in post-Hegelian shadowboxing. Marx's subsequent work with Engels on the German ideology made this charge in the vituperative, biting tone that would come to characterize all of Marx's polemics against those who, in myriad ways, failed to take into account the existing state of affairs and its underlying dynamics. Analysis and critique had to remain in the present conjuncture, determine its contradictory dynamics, confront them unshrinkingly, and use the resulting tensions to motivate the actualization of new truths. By recognizing how Marx situated himself between his two mentors, borrowing and rejecting parts of each in turn so as to deal with his academic unemployment and the insufficiency of Hegelianism in the face of an increasingly repressive society, we are better able to appreciate the intellectual cul-de-sacs Marx broke through in his subsequent intellectual developments. And I think just in terms of sociology of academia, we're trending in some similar directions. Two of these developments that Marx worked through, I think, need to be highlighted. The first was Marx's keen and growing interest in responding to the historical determinants of social reality. The second was his growing commitment to empirical social analysis. Following Marx's critique of Feuerbach, there is no sensuous and needy human, but there are sensuous and needy individuals, beings whose specific conditions and lived experience condition the activity, potency, consciousness, and needs of their humanity, and thus their possibilities for contributing to or challenging a state of affairs. Marx consistently sought to trace these conditions in the midst of their unfolding. His goal was to gain expert knowledge of the landscape in which activity challenging the logic of this unfolding could be developed. Feuerbach's philosophical approach could be described as operating ahistorically in the era of political ideology, whereas Marx went a step further and made philosophy gain its truth by developing accounts of what moves social conditions and motivating challenges to them. Making this move committed Marx to developing both meta-sociological and normative commitments. He turned to the latter, normative commitments, in his famous 1844 manuscripts, and would subsequently fill in these frames with the sociological work which would become the focus of so much of the rest of his life. But what made these crucial developments possible after the March or August 1842 breaks I've highlighted? The best way to mark these shifts is to follow the conditions underlying Marx's changing position on, unsurprisingly, communism. Whereas in October of 1842, Marx responded to the red baiting of his Rheinische Zeitung by insisting that the reality of communism was to be found, if at all, as a Platonic idea. A month later he demanded that this idea of communism be handled with full and straightforward discussion. When the life of a state-supported intellectual seemed possible, Marx was highly idealist. In the following year, when an academic life was impossible, Marx rejected any possible communism insofar as its idealism lacked a practical basis. And in short order, he began his own development of just this practical basis for communism. Once Marx related philosophical goals to concretely analyzing historically determined possibilities for resisting oppressive social systems, the stage was set for his movement from idealism to abstract materialism and ultimately to a materially grounded revolutionary communism. The earliest result of this increasingly radical commitment was the short-lived Deutsch-Französische Jahrbücher. The brief life of this journal marked a series of radical turns which would further refine Marx's political commitments. Indeed, a reviewer of the Jahrbücher in the Augsburg Allgemeine Zeitung said, "The criticism to which this new Paris journal resorts knows no mercy. In its polemics, it disregards all aesthetic standards, and its satirical tone, though it does not, stab like a dagger, punches like a huge fist. Wow, right. The draft program of the Yarbrough explicitly listed public institutions, the political regime, and the servility of most critics as its special objects of critique. After the Yarbrough was silenced, Marx had little patience for even active critics who thought of themselves as realizing the truth of philosophy abstractly or theoretically, and instead moved to a broad study of economics so as to reveal the contours of social organization in its actual development. Marx's radicalization stemmed from personal conditions familiar to those experienced by many today. So this is my summary and conclusion. Academic unemployment or self-censorship, abstract atheism, state repression, the loss of liberal hope, the rise of political reaction, and the unproductive dead ends of ungrounded and non-confrontational critical theory. This radicalization also occurred in the midst of growing social unrest, the emergence of new forms of labor and labor resistance, and a growing contradiction between purported political ideas and bankrupt political institutions. With the courage to soberly confront the actual conditions of his life in the early 1840s, Marx's rapid development towards the ruthless criticism of existing conditions could proceed apace. In doing so, Marx insisted that the critical theory of his day shy away neither from its theoretical results nor from conflict with the powers implicated in its conclusions. The truth of philosophy could only be gained by concretely grounding analysis in existing social conditions so as to first identify and then crucially to organize effective response to the structures and logics of oppression. In the process of developing this project, Marx certainly got a lot right. The problem, however, is that such a way of thinking about Marx risks ignoring his, as well as our own, socio-historical conditions of aligning what is true or right with what is actual. Both Marx's own trajectory, his development in and through social conditions, as well as contemporary conditions, need to be appreciated for their capacity to engender interventions into future structures and directions of radical development. A clear-sighted, expert analysis of actual conditions required developing or refining an existing stock of sociological and theoretical tools. And in this way, so much of Marx's work can be seen as propedeutic and motivation to actualize philosophy's truth as freedom. As academics, journalists, critics, and activists pass through so many similar social conditions today, we do well to remember that Marx's project is right or achieves its truth in and through the ways the tools it develops participate in the reorganization of conditions through which society might actually foster meaningful freedom. Thanks.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.